This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You look at all the subsidies that we have at the federal level in this country, all of the industries that avail themselves of tax breaks, right or wrong, they're there. Why aren't we thinking about that when it comes to the cost of getting water to people?
6 weeks ago, filmmaker James Redford passed away from cancer at the age of 58. He came on Sea Change Radio as a guest in 2012 to discuss his documentary film Watershed, which provides the story of the Colorado River through the voices of its beneficiaries, from a fly fisherman to a rancher to a Navajo council member. The film is narrated by Jamie's father, actor Robert Redford, and this week on Sea Change Radio, we remember James Redford by revisiting our 2012 discussion. Jamie explains some of the water issues related to the Colorado River, many of which persist today, and how these lessons can help inform conservation efforts around the globe. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Redford. He's the producer of the documentary film Watershed. Jamie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
The film's fascinating, and it focuses on the Colorado River and its offshoots. It's a lot larger than Colorado, obviously, and the impact is much greater than just the state of Colorado. It's a perfect example of some of the issues that we have with water management, but why did you decide to focus on the Colorado River, and what was the inspiration for the film?
At the core, it's a family project. It comes out of the Redford Center, which is a nonprofit based at Sundance, Utah, and our family really believes in the transformative power of good storytelling, and particularly documentaries, that you can actually move the bar forward on certain topics by telling important stories. And in this case, I think the whole family feels that water is quickly becoming one of the most important issues, not only to the West, but to the whole country, because if it's not scarcity, it's quality in our country. And we have emerging crises in both of those areas. So for us being, you know, part-time Westerners, having my sisters and I grew up in Manhattan, but we spent all of our summers and vacations in Utah, I think we had a particular pull to the challenges that were facing the Colorado River watershed basin and wanted to tell that story first and foremost. And about 3 years ago, we had a conference at Sundance Resort and pulled in stakeholders that were connected to the issue of water conservation or water usage, water distribution. So we had water officials from California, from the Central Valley. We had people from Arizona. We had migrant workers. We had representatives from the Navajo Nation. We had recreational representatives that use the Colorado River for their livelihood. We had agricultural representatives. And, you know, as you can imagine, there were a lot of different opinions about how to deal with water. You know, they're definitely not always on the same page. But one thing everyone agreed about is that people are totally ignorant about water. And that before you tried to get anybody involved in helping sort of the pressures that are facing the Colorado River, you had to start with sort of a 101 basic introduction to what the issues are. So we thought, oh, that's good. I think we can actually do that because, frankly, none of us are water experts. I mean, I can get in a room of water experts, and they're over my head in minutes with some of the terminology they use to describe water flows and acres and foot acres and, you know, all of these things. But certainly in terms of trying to tell a story that would help people understand what's at stake there in the Colorado River Basin, we felt like we could do that, so we did. I'll be honest with you. I've certainly had my lawns. I've been a water consumer like anybody else. And one could say that making this movie is the thing that made the light go off in my head. But it wasn't. It actually happened before that. It happened because I live in Marin County. Marin County has its own local watershed. When it rains, In Marin, we have water, and when it doesn't, we don't have water. If people stop using water, and they're not paying for that water, then how do you pay to run the whole water system, right? So there's an odd thing going on in a lot of municipalities around they need you to use water to pay for the infrastructure.
Walk us through first some of the A to Z of the actual Colorado River and what it would naturally look like and what it looks like today.
Sure. Well, the Continental Divide that runs down through the spine of the Rocky Mountains, water that goes to the east heads towards the Missouri and the Mississippi and ends up either down out through Texas or the into the Gulf of Mexico, and that's the watershed that heads east. The watershed that heads west, the Colorado River is starting in the headwaters are in on the backside of the Front Range in Colorado, in communities like Steamboat, Granby, Grand Lake. That water flows westward down through western Colorado, joins with a number of rivers as it goes, the Yampa, the White, the Green.
Those are pretty big rivers. Green River is like one of the main rivers that cuts through western Colorado, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, these are not trickling tributaries. These are powerful rivers in and of themselves. So by the time it all comes together in central southern Utah, you've got a massive body of water.
Which formed the Grand Canyon, essentially, yes. Right?
That's right. And it heads south all the way down and ultimately, ended up down in the Colorado River Delta, which is basically the northern end of the Baja Peninsula. And the water would empty out into that peninsula and was at one time one of the most important migratory bird flyover spots in North America and home to a local shrimp economy for the local Native Americans, as well as trade routes. As little as 50, 60 years ago, these things were still in place. Today, if you go down there, it's a desert. Today, the waters that come down to the west of the Continental Divide, before they even reach a place like Glenwood Springs near Aspen, almost half the water has been diverted to pumped over the Front Range to the residents of Denver and the various communities up and down the Front Range. And as our fly fisherman character says in the movie, you got to wonder sometimes when you see millions of acres of green lawns all through the, maybe not millions. When you see, the vast, vast amount of green lawns along the Front Range, and you think, wow, they're willing to destroy a beautiful natural scenery up here in order to create an artificial one down there, that's a fundamental problem right off the start, And you take someone like John Wesley Powell, who on the one, a great explorer, one-armed Civil War veteran who threw together nine men to go down the river with him and explore it in a wooden rowboat, managed to survive a harrowing trip down the river. This was a man that went on to be a believer in water reclamation. So in some ways, people have varying opinions about how he saw water could be used. But one thing's for certain, he really understood that people that lived in the West were not going to be able to replicate the environment that they came from back east. We were not going to be able to move west and have Kentucky bluegrass and agriculture that resembled our roots back on the East Coast. And he said, unless we learn to inhabit the western arid area on its own terms, we're going to end up with problems. And that is something that he said in 1880.
This was before golf really took off.
Yeah, exactly. And boy, was he right.
It made me think when I saw the pictures of the golf courses in the film of one of our guests that we had a couple years back on Sea Change Radio, John Perry Barlow, the Grateful Dead lyricist and also an activist for internet freedoms. He's, I think, one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He told a story about being on a plane next to a guy who he derisively characterized as a golfer. He said he had the yellow pants. He was a golfer. They were looking together down at the desert as they were passing over, and he said, "Wow, you got a lot of golf courses here. Where's all that water coming from?" And the golfer said, "Well, we got aquifers that'll last 100 years, they say, to water all these golf courses." And he said that 100 years like that was an eternity. And when you start thinking about kids and their kids, like 100 years is not that long. So if we empty out those aquifers in 100 years for golf courses in this region, that's just a crime. But there are some solutions, and your film Watershed really approaches it from a positive standpoint as well. Why don't you talk about some of the innovators who are spotlighted in the film?
Well, first of all, I think it is important to say that, you know, there's no doubt that the film has a sort of a positive tone. And that is by design. And usually when I have a Q&A after a screening, someone inevitably raises their hand. And most often it's someone who's a really, really, you know, hardworking in the trenches activist who's a little annoyed by the fact that it has a positive tone, who feels that there's nothing positive here. You know, look at, we've got 50 million people that are going to move into the Colorado River Basin over the next 20 years. There's currently 30 million. You've got agriculture, you've got industry sipping at that river relentlessly. You know, what's to be positive about? And I share some of the alarmism and concern. But I think I look at this, I try to take it apart step by step, and see it as, you know, the first thing is you have to have an understanding and sort of build a certain kind of trust about what the bottom line is. And if there's one thing I've learned from being a part-time Westerner, but, you know, you don't get anywhere with the Rocky Mountain folks by depressing them. No, you know, you're just going to turn them away. There is so much, as our fly fishing guide Jeff Ehlert says in the film, there's always so much doom and gloom in the media, I don't know what to believe. And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, you have to, particularly today with the extraordinary amount of information overload we have. Crying out for some soup. I believe I had taken it on. Made a little water of love. Water of love, deep in the ground. But there ain't no water here to be found. Someday, baby, where the
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with filmmaker James Redford. I was wondering, when you talk about the family in L.A. who do a lot of biking and reclaim their water, they have a great little gray water set up. How much of that, of the L.A. water, is coming from the Colorado River? Is the water from the Colorado River feeding Los Angeles County?
The Colorado River is the primary source of water for Los Angeles.
Wow.
And you do have a local watershed. The complexities for Southern California is that we've created an environment with all of our urban development and suburban development and our use of pesticides and insecticides and other chemical applications, herbicides on our lawns, that when it does rain in Southern California and you do have an abundant amount of local water during the wet years, the El Nino years, for instance, the concern about that water, rather than how to use it, is how to prevent that chemically burdened water from polluting the ocean. You know, that's a really bizarre problem.
70%, you cite in the movie, 70% of the water from the Colorado River is now used for agricultural purposes. Is that correct?
That's the other segment. I mean, I think Los Angeles is representative, as is Las Vegas, as is San Diego, as is Denver. Major metropolitan areas are a big draw on that river. From an industrial point of view, agriculture is by far the most significant user of the water. And, you know, nobody's going to want agriculture to go away. Nobody is pretending that it isn't a critical part of our economic machine nationally. But the question is, you know, how do we start? Let's face it, we have more people, more industry, and less water. I mean, you know, the amount of water in the Colorado River right now, for various reasons, you can point to climate change if you like, I certainly do, but even beyond that, even if it's just a long-term weather trend, there's less water in the river now than there was when they divided it up in 1922. And yet we have infinite amount more of usage. So we have an approaching shortage, and it's going to get worse and worse. And instead of, you know, waiting until we have some sort of calamity that turns county against county or city against city or state against state, why don't we get smart? I mean, there's a lot of technology and a lot of alternatives to how to use what's there in a more appropriate way. And agriculture has an, you know, excuse the pun, but there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, you know, in terms of water usage. They can do a lot to use less. And I think right now what we want to do, everybody, we have to start by using less. And a big difference can be made right there.
Jamie, you spoke about the 1922 division of the Colorado River. Give our listeners a little bit more of a history lesson on how that all worked.
Sure. Yeah, the 1922 Colorado River Compact was led by the United States and later amended to include details for Mexico, basically setting out a roadmap for the allocation of the river. The river flows through 7 U.S. states and 2 Mexican states. And the question is, who gets to use how much and how to divvy up that river? So when they allocated to each state a certain amount of water back in 1922, there was at that time a historic high level of flow in the river that did not represent the norm. So when they said, okay, well, we need such and such acre feet of water for this state and such for that state, right off the bat, the numbers were errant, because as it proved out over the next 20, 30 years, particularly once you got into the great drought in the mid-30s, there was a lot less water there. But it really hasn't been until the last 30 to 40 years that shortage of supply began to show up and really, really mean something. But when I talk about divvying up the water, it's not just a matter of who gets it, but how is it stored and how is it distributed? One of the issues facing the Colorado River, besides dropping water levels, and we can talk about the delta is now a desert, but aside from that, you have a lot of dams up and down the Colorado River and on the tributaries. And dams themselves, there's no doubt that dams have provided a certain amount of, well, a significant amount of safety for some of the communities that may have historically experienced devastating floods during flood cycles and flood years. But the long term, those dams have come at a real cost in terms of both water quality and not only water quality, but water availability, ironically. I mean, every year, if you look at Lake Powell, which sits behind the Great Glen Canyon Dam, because that water sits there as it does, high up, exposed rather than down deep inside the canyon and moving, it's a still body of water that goes back more than 100 miles into Utah. And every year, enough water evaporates off Lake Powell to supply Los Angeles with all of its water needs every single year. So here we are creating dams to create hydroelectric power. We're trying to create a safer environment for the communities that live close to the rivers. And yet now we've created a problem where one of the largest cities, if not the largest metropolitan areas in our country, could get by on that evaporating water.
So what are your long-term goals with the film?
A lot of times when you make a documentary film, the idea is to create awareness or spark concern or trigger action. And, you know, Watershed is no exception, in spite of the fact that we interview people that are actively working on positive solutions, and it doesn't really have an alarmist flavor. It is meant to drive action. We do feel that, you know, by enjoying the beauty of that canyon, enjoying how wonderful the people are and the cultures are that, that rely on the Colorado River, you'll actually be more interested in restoring the Great Colorado to the Delta. And we're in the process right now of designing a campaign to get water back to the Delta. It sounds like a tall order, but in actuality, it isn't. And the reason it isn't is that it's merely a matter of money. And it's not a matter of politics. It's not a matter of huge sea changes in culture. And this is a situation where in the next month, we're going to know it's going to be somewhere between $15 and $17 million, a one-time purchase of water rights that will be available that will allow enough water to come down into the Colorado River Delta to restore the flow, restore the natural bird habitat, restore the beauty that was really meant to be there in the first place. And if you think about that money and you broke it up by the 30 million people that live in the Colorado River Basin and rely on the Colorado River right now, you know, what would that be? I mean, you know, I've always been bad at math, but if everybody were to chip in, it wouldn't be that much to get that river back to where it belongs. So whether it ends up being a series of nonprofits, some wealthy philanthropic interest, or a more vast grassroots effort, I have a feeling it's going to take everything. But what you're going to see from the Redford Center over the next 3 to 6 months is a commitment to getting that water back where it belongs.
Flood water spreading all around. Flood water spreading all around. People everywhere trying to make higher ground. Many met their maker in a watery grave.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined by filmmaker James Redford. He's the producer of the new documentary film Watershed. One of the questions I had when I was watching the movie was, you say that the Thousand Lake region has cheaper water costs than a lot of the people from these seemingly more arid regions of the country in the Colorado River Basin. Why is that?
Yeah, in the great in the Thousand Lakes area in Minnesota, it actually costs more to use water up there than it does in Denver. And primarily, the water in Denver that's used to water the lawns and to drink and shower has been pumped all the way over the Great Front Range. How can that be? Well, it's all a matter of policy. It's all a matter of politics. It's all a matter of people deciding what's in the best interest of who. And in the case of water, there's always been a very, very close relationship between real estate development and water usage. And if water's cheap, people will build. So there's always been a tradition of making water plentiful, abundant, and cheap. And when you're talking about areas that are in the midst of rapid growth. So there's an artificial mechanism in place. And when you look at something like water municipalities, you look at all the subsidies that we have at the federal level in this country, all of the industries that avail themselves of tax breaks, right or wrong, they're there. Why aren't we thinking about that when it comes to the cost of getting water to people? Why are we making these municipalities, putting them in a position where they feel like they can't afford to conserve water? That makes no sense at all. I mean, particularly in the long run. It's, you know, you talk about low-hanging fruit. Some of the issues are like this. Some of the issues are big issues in which change needs to happen at the federal or state level.
So what are some of the challenges that your organization and your dad have faced being a little bit more in public scrutiny than if you were an unknown real estate development company and trying to make sure that all the ends meet and that you're doing the right thing?
Well, it's interesting. You know, my father, as long as I can remember, has always had a visceral care for nature. I remember I was 7 years old when he bought the Timp Haven Ski Resort in Utah. We'd settled in the North Fork of the Provo Canyon as a family, my mother being from Provo. And he was in love with that canyon, and the local ski area came up for sale. And he bought it because there was a plan to do 500 half-acre residential parcels in the canyon. And it was so abhorrent to him that buying that ski area was actually a protective, defensive move rather than a financially opportunistic move. And he would, and our family would be the first person to tell you that in the ensuing 40 years, it certainly has been anything but a financial opportunity. The ski business is a tough business just to stay afloat in, frankly. And you know, to be involved in commerce, to be involved in some real estate development, is you know, it's an interesting challenge when your motivations are really to try and preserve and sustain, which is really where we come from. I mean, we've got, we just about 5 years ago, we put 2,000 acres of Sundance lands into a trust. We, you know, put aside, I'm trying to think of what the actual phrase is, and we gave those up to you to open lands to make sure that the land would never be touched going forward. Certainly that land, there's a lot of other things that we could have done with that land. However, we've also done very small, intimate, limited development because we want it to be a place where people can come and enjoy and connect with nature. And you can't do that in a vacuum. There are places that need to be left untouched for the sake of being untouched. I would say the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is a good example of that. But, you know, people tend to think of my father as a radical environmentalist who's just anti-everything. That's really not true. If you look going back to the mid-80s, he had a nonprofit called the Institute for Resource Management, which was really concerned with bringing opposing sides together to try and find common ground. Because he felt, and if you can imagine this, you know, he felt at the time that the country had become very polarized. And, you know, boy, little did we
know. Back then, huh? It seemed polarized.
You know, so, and, you know, he's always been interested in trying to find a balance because we're not going to get anywhere by just shutting down businesses. You know, we have to try and do things in the right way. And that's been a very personal goal for both my father and myself and my sisters, to try and navigate a line between, you know, what do we have to preserve for the future and what do we have to sustain for now.
Jamie Redford, the new film is Watershed. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, the Notting Hill Billies, and Eric Bibb. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.